This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
How did the universe begin? How did the first galaxies form? And how did life emerge? These fundamental questions are at the core of a new mission called SpheREx, a space telescope that will study the deep sky in the hope of unlocking some of the secrets of the cosmos. This episode, I got to speak to Dr. Jamie Bock, who is leading the investigation, to find out more.
I'm Jamie Bock. I'm a professor of physics at the California Institute of Technology and a senior research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab.
Thanks very much for speaking to me today, Jamie. And the reason where our paths have crossed is because we've been looking at the SpheREx mission, which you're a part of, obviously. And I was wondering if we could just start off the podcast by you sort of introducing SpheREx and a little bit about how the mission came about and how you became involved in it.
Sure. Recently, SpheREx passed into what is called Phase C. So there was a press release about that. And so that's the phase now where we get to go ahead and build hardware. The project has been in development for a number of years. But let me just say a little bit about what SpheREx does. It's a relatively small astrophysics mission, but aspires to answer some big questions. The three questions that we're trying to address is how the universe began, how did galaxies begin, and what were the conditions for life outside the solar system? So those are big, important questions, but let me say a little bit about what we actually do. So SpheREx will take spectra over the full sky. So we're going to map the full sky at near-infrared wavelengths. Those wavelengths start from about 0.75 micron, just where your eyes end in the visible part of the spectrum, and goes out to 5 microns. And we split up the light into small channels. So each channel, the resolution varies a bit, but it's something like 1% to 3% of the wavelength we can see. So that's fairly low resolution spectroscopy. And we map the sky at all these wavelengths. And at the end of every 6 months, we have a full spectral map of the sky. So that's a new capability in astronomy. It's the first mission of its type. And so we have an enormous amount of spectra that are produced this way. Now, let me just say a little bit about the three questions. And I'll start with what's perhaps the easiest one to think about, which is what were the conditions for life outside the solar system? So if we look at the Earth, which is our one data point for how life came about, life on Earth is very closely associated with liquid water. I've actually done some experiments on the plateau in Antarctica where there is no liquid water and there's no visible signs of life up there. And you can contrast that with what goes on at the edge of the continent when you're near the oceans, where there's lots of sea life. And so how did that water get to the Earth? Well, we think that the materials for water were actually born in the interstellar medium. And that water came somehow through the evolution of the solar system into the inner planets and eventually formed the oceans that constitute the Earth. And if we go back and look how water forms in the interstellar medium, in dense molecular clouds where stars are born, the vast majority of that water is actually in the form of ice that forms on the mantles of dust grains. It's not in the form of liquid, certainly, and it's not in the form of vapor. And it's not just water that forms on those dust grains. There are other materials, many of them containing organic material, such as carbon dioxide or methanol. And we can look at the abundance of those materials by doing spectroscopy on them. So basically, we can have a background star and look at how those materials absorb. And so this has been done for a handful of sources, but with spherics, we can basically do this over the full sky. So we expect to see the abundance of water and other ice materials over at least 20,000 sources, but probably millions. So that's going to be a real game changer. And the idea is we can see how, you know, ices start natively. And then when we look at some systems that are in the early stages of star and planet formation, we can see if those ice abundances or composition evolve as we go into the, you know, early stages when stars are forming and then when stars have a disk of material that starts to accrete and turn into planets. We'll even see some systems that are maybe going through a late bombardment phase, like our solar system was doing, and perhaps that's one of the ways that these materials got into the inner solar system.
It's really interesting hearing about the sort of abundance of water that you're talking about there, because when we sort of think about, you know, the search for signs of life in our own solar system, we're searching for water, you know, in sort of, for example, the subsurface oceans of moons like Enceladus and Europa, and it seems like there's quite a sort of limited data points, as you've said, in our own solar system to find water, but within that interstellar medium, it seems that water's actually really, really abundant then.
Indeed, right. Yes. And in fact, as I said, it's mostly in the form of these ices. And there's only been a limited amount of work done with some previous infrared missions. So this is like the first systematic survey of the abundance of the ice materials.
When you say that SphereX is going to look at the whole sky, what do you actually mean by that? Do you mean like if I was to go outside tonight and look at the entire sky from my point of view, it would be like that? Or is it the entirety of the 360 degree view around the Earth?
It's the entirety of the 360 degree view. Because we're in space, we're actually going around the Earth pole to pole many times every day. We have access to the entire sky. And so we'll create a 360 degree map, a bit like Google Earth, but looking the other way in all these colors.
And so what sort of instruments does the spacecraft have on board to help you take the data and then, I suppose, study it?
Right. So SphereX does one thing. So the instrument, the whole concept was really developed by the SphereX team. And it's a very specialized instrument to do this in rapid fashion. So it's actually a fairly small telescope, only a 20 centimeter aperture, but don't let the small size fool you, because we collect an enormous amount of light by having a huge field of view on the sky. So even though the aperture itself is small, the light gathering power is very large. And then we had to come up with some tricks to actually get the spectra in a way that was both efficient and not very expensive, because this is a cost-capped mission. So we basically put a filter where the band pass varies over the filter just right on top of the detectors. This is actually a method that was developed for planetary science and was not really known in astrophysics. I guess we knew about it, but we didn't. We rediscovered it. Because in astrophysics, normally you want to put all your pixels on the one source that you're interested in. And you know, if you have pixels that aren't viewing that source, they're kind of wasted. But in this case, really, the source of interest is the full sky. So you can do that. And so then the trick is we have to take a bunch of pictures to kind of build up a complete spectra for every given object.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, I suppose also when you think about looking for water and signs of life beyond the solar system, elsewhere in the galaxy, in the universe, you also think of exoplanets. I mean, is the study of exoplanets part of the SphereX plan?
Right. Well, because we're in a small telescope, we can't really, you know, resolve individual objects very well. We don't have the, you know, supervision of something like Hubble or a large telescope. There are some unique things we would do in that. It turns out when studying exoplanets, if you're trying to understand the mass and the radius of the exoplanet, one of the biggest uncertainties is actually the property of the host star. So with Spherix, we'll measure the properties of all these host stars. And so that actually will help quite a bit understanding the properties of the exoplanets in detail. Let me just move along here, if you like, to the other science goals that we're going to address. So the next one, as we move further out, is to understand how galaxies formed. And again, because we have a small telescope, we're going to do this in a unique way. We're studying something called the extragalactic background light, and it's the reason the night sky isn't perfectly dark. It also isn't, you know, there's this paradox going way back called Olber's paradox, which is why isn't the night sky the brightness of a star? Because if the universe were static, you would always see the surface of a star eventually. And the answer to that paradox is, you know, the universe isn't static and infinite. It has a finite lifetime. So the universe has a glow that's left over from all the light produced by galaxies over cosmic time. And so studying this glow is a way to see if we're catching all the light, because we get all the light produced over the history of the universe. We're doing this in a specialized way. So instead of just seeing the total brightness, we use the fact that the galaxies cluster together. So there's kind of a spatial variation in this background glow. And so by measuring the glow in multiple colors, we can see the total light produced by galaxies and then take it apart and look at how the galaxies formed over history. So we think the first galaxies turned on, you know, several hundred million years after the Big Bang, and they formed out of primordial hydrogen and helium. Maybe star formation was somewhat different at that time. And this is a period that we'd like to know more about. There isn't a lot of data yet, but it has distinctive signatures because of the fact that it's born in primordial hydrogen and helium. When these galaxies turn on, the stars turn on, the photons, the ultraviolet photons from the stars actually ionize all the hydrogen and helium between galaxies. So the universe today, all that hydrogen and helium is almost perfectly ionized. But this early epoch, that was not the case. So, you know, we're hoping that we can go and see if we can detect this early epoch and then say more about the formation of galaxies that way.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting things I always find about these missions that are sort of looking back towards deeper and deeper into the universe, because you're sort of ultimately looking back in time, aren't you?
That's right, yes. We get to be historians as cosmologists. Most of the galaxies we can see with a telescope in your backyard are incredibly far away, but they're not that far away in a cosmological sense. The furthest galaxies back would be 13 billion light years back, looking into the past. And we know as we look further in the past, we see galaxies evolve; they change in time. And this first epoch of galaxies, there's really not a lot of data, but it's going to be very interesting to see what we can say about that.
Yeah, just how far back could you look? I mean, I take it it's not really actually possible to go back and see sort of seconds after the Big Bang, is it?
So I should emphasize, this is kind of an indirect measurement. We see the glow of many galaxies all put together. So we're not seeing the individual objects. We're kind of seeing the galactic ensemble that way. And bigger telescopes have to go and look at the individual galaxies. And, the interesting thing is we can take those measurements of individual galaxies that have been done by generations of astronomers and see if that really matches up with what we get when we look at the total light emitted, because it's possible that total light came from very faint or diffuse sources that would be missed.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when I was sort of reading about SphereX is that one of the terms that kept coming up is inflation. I was wondering if you could explain what that's about and the role that plays in the mission.
Right. So that's our third science goal, to understand how the universe began. Current cosmological theory says the universe was born in this hot Big Bang. And then in the 1980s or so, theoretical cosmologists started to get uncomfortable with that picture because there were certain things that couldn't quite explain. So one is why is the universe approximately flat geometrically? And why is it as smooth as we see it? Because if you take Einstein's equations, the universe pretty quickly would depart. If its initial conditions were a little bit not flat, for example, today it would be, very far from flat, but yet we see something that is close to flat. So the theory that came up to explain this is something called inflation, which is that the universe goes through this really violent, rapid, exponential expansion in the earliest moments. We're talking here like times of a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. And in this expansion, space expands so violently, you can think of it like space expands faster than the speed of light. In other words, if there were two objects in communication, the space between them would expand so rapidly that they would actually go out of communication. And so this idea of inflation is consistent with Einstein's equation. So there's no paradox here that you can have inflation do this. Space expand faster than the speed of light. Although it sounds very counterintuitive. The other thing that this does is it explains why the universe is so homogeneous, because the patches of the universe we see weren't independent. They were all in contact at this early time before inflation happened, and then took that little region and spread it out. It explains why the universe, the geometry is roughly flat, because you know, any intrinsic geometry gets blown way up. It's like why the surface of the Earth now looks flat, you know, because it's been stretched so much. When you look locally, it looks flat, even though it might have some other geometry. So the trick here is that the mechanism that drives inflation isn't understood. It's happening at energies that there's no laws of physics that we can use. It's beyond the energies that you find in the standard model in particle physics. So the physics that cause inflation are, I guess you'd call them phenomenological. We need to fill in what did that. In other words, you can get this effect in Einstein's equations if you change the matter-energy part. So we think of matter as being gravitationally attractive, but it can also have a pressure. Light can have a pressure, for example. And if that pressure were negative instead of positive, it can cause this kind of expansion. It's perfectly fine with Einstein's equations again, but you need some kind of unusual substance to do it.
This all sort of reminds me of the sort of problems experienced with things like dark energy and dark matter. Is it in that sort of realm of sort of trying to understand these unknown quantities and forces in the universe?
Well, it's a bit like dark energy. Our dark energy has the same signature in that, you know, it will causes the expansion to accelerate, you know, and today that appears to be happening, thankfully, a much more gradual process than at the beginning. But the basic idea is the same. And of course, we're trying to find out what constitutes dark energy. At these early times, as I said, you know, we don't have really the framework to probe the physics. So our best measurements to date will probably be the universe itself. Inflation also has some pretty profound implications. One of them is that the noise that happened at the time of inflation is really driven by quantum mechanics. So the quantum mechanical noise then got stretched out to these large scales. So the galaxies and clusters of galaxies we see today really had this quantum mechanical source, a birth. And that's, you know, a fantastic idea that the largest things we see today are connected to the very smallest things. The other implication is that the observable universe, which is incredibly vast, you know, that got expanded by inflation, but we don't know how big the universe was at the time that inflation happened. And it's very likely that the universe itself goes beyond what we can see by many, many orders of magnitude. So not only, you know, is the sun not the center of the universe, but we can't even see the entire universe by a long stretch. It's kind of the ultimate Copernican revolution. You know, I think this is all fascinating, but I'd really like to get some measurements to learn more about this. And that's where spherics comes in. So there, it's, you know, probing inflation at these very early times. I mean, we can't even see the light that was present in the universe at that time. It's not possible. So we have to use indirect measurements to learn more about inflation. So inflation was obviously a big event, and these quantum mechanical fluctuations that got blown up to enormous scales by inflation kind of set up the seeds for galaxy formation to proceed. And so one way to study inflation is to actually look at how galaxies are distributed today. If we go look at the very largest scales, that initial set of fluctuations should still be visible in the pattern of how galaxies are distributed. So with our spectroscopic power here with spherics, we plot the positions of all these galaxies, hundreds of millions of galaxies, and their distribution is sensitive to these initial conditions that were set up by inflation. So we can work backwards from that distribution and say more about, you know, what were the basic properties of inflation. So in particular, the question we're looking at was inflation kind of simple and driven by a single field, you know, single energy source, or were there multiple fields? And so the statistical distribution of these galaxies can help us answer that question.
To me, it sounds like when you describe each of those three threads that Spherix is going to be studying, it sounds to me like any one of those alone could be justification for a mission and an entire science team. Is it a challenge to sort of have one mission and one team, you know, dedicated to those three incredible and far-reaching questions?
Well, we're fortunate. We're blessed and cursed with all the scientific richness. It was kind of one of these amazing things where we had, when the mission was born, there was a study group, and you know there are a bunch of ideas that were kicked around, and it's just an amazing coincidence, if you like, that there were these three themes that were very closely related, could all be done kind of with the same capabilities. So, you know, that was really exciting. But yes, handling all the data, and, you know, these are difficult problems. They need to be done really carefully. That is a challenge, because Spherix is one of these missions with a strict cost cap. So we have to cram all this analysis into, you know, the available resources.
So what's next for the mission then? What's left to prepare, and when's it going to launch?
Yeah, so the way NASA develops missions is we go through a set of phases. As I alluded, it starts out with a competitive study phase. So it's called phase A. We went through that and compete with other missions, and NASA picks one of them. Then there's a more detailed study phase. Of course, the development time is pretty short. So in that study phase, we have to order, you know, long lead time items like the detectors and the telescope, and complete our study at the same time. And now we've made the transition from that second study phase B into phase C, which is when we get to build and test the instrument and procure the spacecraft. And then after that, so that phase lasts about 2 years. And then after that, we integrate with the spacecraft, which is provided by Ball Aerospace in Boulder, Colorado. And then we go out and launch. The schedule's been a little unpredictable, of course, with COVID, but we're aiming for a mid-2024 launch. So it's all pretty quick in terms of the development of a space mission. After launch, Spherix will observe the sky for at least 2 years, which gives us four complete maps. It'll be a fire hose of data that comes with that. I mean, it's not just the three science themes that I mentioned either. We will be producing these, you know, unique spectral maps for the entire science community that get to pore over the data. And because it's a new thing, there's going to be lots of rich and interesting science in that data as well.
I think a lot of people, when you say sort of an all sky map, a mission like that, a lot of people might think of the map of the Milky Way, you know, created by the Gaia mission. Can we expect sort of like beautiful, spectacular imagery like that from Spherix?
So we'll have all sky maps like that, but in 102 colors. They won't have the, you know, fine resolution of Gaia, but they'll have this unique spectroscopy to it. And, you know, there'll be lots of things that astronomers can do with it. I mentioned this application of studying the star host stars of exoplanet systems, but also, you know, there'll be hundreds of millions of galaxies to study in spectra, and especially anything you can do with multiple types and combine them together. There's a huge statistical database there. For example, some galaxies have host massive black holes, they're called quasars, And we don't know how far out quasars exist. They go out to at least a redshift of 7, but they're very rare. And so there's a few that we know that are that far away. But by covering the whole sky with spectra, those kinds of objects would pop out in the spherics data set. And it just goes on and on like that. We've had several workshops where astronomers have come and presented ideas, and every one of these workshops and kind of blown away by the creativity of the community and all the other things that could be, you know. So it's good. One of the things we have to worry about is just there's an incredible temptation to go into the archive and play around. But, you know, we've got a job to do. So the science team has to focus on that.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an absolutely fascinating mission with plenty of science to discover for, I suppose, decades to come. But yeah, I just wanted to wish you all the best with the rest of the mission and good luck and you know, for launch and everything like that. And also, you know, thanks very much for speaking to me today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, or Spotify.